The views expressed in this episode of Squared Circle Gazette Radio aren't necessarily the true opinions of the individuals in the prosecution or the defense, but for the sake of debate, it's time to go to court.
Because for the first time tonight, the trial of Eric Bischoff.
What?
Hello everyone and welcome to the 19th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside Carl Jones.
If you join my law firm, you get a free smoking chimp.
Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening all.
G. John Chase.
Good evening.
And joining us again for the first time in a while, Matt Holt.
The judge does not budge.
And we are here today for the trial of Eric Bischoff, a show that has been a couple of weeks in the making. We had to unfortunately postpone this last week, but we're very much looking forward to doing this. And without much further ado, I'm taking the hosting cap off and putting the sheepskin wig on. And we're going to throw this over to the Honourable Matt Holt to explain the show.
Good evening again, ladies and gentlemen. So, the way we're going to do this, we're going to have two teams. The prosecution will be made up of Mr. Liam O'Rourke and Mr. G. John Chase.
Yeah!
Yeah! And standing opposite the side of them is going to be the defence, made up of Carl Jones and Kieran O'Rourke.
Go team!
The charge being brought against Mr. Eric Bischoff is... Eric Bischoff was the person most responsible for the death of WCW via malpractice and negligence. We'll begin with opening statements, and I'd like to hand over firstly to the prosecution, Mr. G. John Chase.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honour. 14 years ago, there was a heinous crime. The professional wrestling world witnessed the death of a beloved company, World Championship Wrestling. And we're all here today because in these last 14 years, nobody has been held accountable for this crime. WCW was a company that should not have died. In its prime in 1998, WCW was earning as much as $250 million. But yet, 2 years later, in 2000, it was on a loss of $67 million. That's incomprehensible. The defense are most likely going to bamboozle you with different names like Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash and Vince Russo. And they're going to claim that these men are more likely responsible than Eric Bischoff. But the prosecution is going to clearly state that out of all the percentages of everybody that got involved and damaged WCW, that the largest percentage belonged to Eric Bischoff. It was his decisions that caused the most damage to WCW in the long run. Even to the point where even after Eric Bischoff left the company, there was nothing anyone could do to bring it back. Not even Vince Russo. The superb Vince Russo.
Order.
Yeah. We will systematically go through all the decisions that Eric Bischoff has made that was damaging to the company. Where was his friendships with the wrestlers, the business decisions he made and the contracts that he signed, and also his failure to create new stars for the future of that company. 14 years on, as I said, nobody has been charged with this crime, and now's the chance that someone is going to have to answer for this crime. And that man is Eric Bischoff.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chase. And now, for the defence, with opening statements, Mr. Kieran O'Rourke.
Thank you very much, Judge. First of all, let it be known categorically that we deny that Eric Bischoff has ever killed a hyena or any other form of wildlife, and neither did he kill WCW. When we look at the facts, it's quite obvious that WCW was in a better position when Bischoff left than when he started. Eric Bischoff was fundamentally a facilitator within WCW, and as such, both the credit for WCW's successes and the accusations of blame for its final downfall should really be put into context. We believe Eric Bischoff didn't kill WCW. He is at worst a victim, as well as we may say beneficiary, of the monstrous environment that was working within inside WCW and inside Turner Broadcasting and eventually the Time Warner conglomerate. It's nothing short of a witch hunt, quite frankly.
I'd like to offer co-counsel an opportunity for brief comments, Mr. Liam O'Rourke.
Thank you, Judge. Just a couple of very quick ones here. Couple of things. There's going to be a lot of comments probably from the defence and probably from the feedback too, saying that Eric Bischoff, just because, you know, he did so well for the company, he did so much good. Just because a guy's a war hero doesn't mean that he can rape and kill a teenage girl and walk from a trial scot-free. That's not the case in real life, and that's not going to be the case here. And as far as I'm concerned, ladies and gentlemen, the whole point that we're going to make here, the centrepiece theme, is that Eric Bischoff made short-term decisions with long-term negative ramifications. And I'll leave it at that.
And co-counsel for the defence, Carl Jones.
Thank you, Your Honour. We will aim to demonstrate that despite the prosecution's claims, Mr. Bischoff, for whatever his perceived faults, in many respects gave this company a stay of execution, credibility it didn't previously have, and success on an unparalleled level. May he have played a role in its demise? Possibly. To go to such grandiose claims as the prosecution, we argue that is very, very narrow-sighted.
Gentlemen, thank you for your opening arguments and opening statements. I'd now like to go, firstly, to the prosecution to raise their first point of evidence.
Yes, thank you. Prosecution's first point towards Eric Bischoff is going to be the signing of Hulk Hogan. Now, we're going to make a great many points, and for me personally, I believe this one to be the biggest one against Eric Bischoff, because first off, it was Eric Bischoff's duty to make changes in WCW when he, you know, was given the reins by Ted Turner. The company was in pretty bad straits when he took over, and he had to make a difference, and he believed that Hulk Hogan was this change. The only issue is with this, was when he signed Hulk Hogan, in his contract, he gave him full creative control to Hulk Hogan himself, on his own brand. Now, in the short term, and I'm sure the defense will go into this, where in the short term, Hulk Hogan was good for business, and did increase buy rates. But in the long run, the signing of Hulk Hogan, and in particular, giving him free reins to control his booking, was detrimental to WCW and its business. If you went first off with a pretty obvious one, which is Starrcade 97, in which Bischoff waited a year to cash in on a Hogan-Sting match, built Sting up, but yet Hogan, due to his obvious ego, essentially jobbed Sting out. And when you carry on through the timeline, you'll see more instances of Hogan holding people down, whether it was Goldberg or any of the mid-carders or cruiserweights. Hulk Hogan was able to do this because of the contract that Bischoff gave him due to his inability to run the company efficiently.
And to the defence for their counter-argument to evidence item number one.
Now, just one sort of a quick point on the periphery of that argument there. The prosecution have claimed that Mr. Bischoff was incredibly short-sighted. They cited that prominently in their opening statement. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to point out there that the Sting-Hogan feud was built over the course of a year. In fact, the initial transition of the Sting character started in 96, midway through 96 the previous year. So there is evidence there of long-term planning. Now, they were very quick to skate over the success of Hogan. Between 1988, when Ted Turner first purchased the company from Jim Crockett, and 1993, the company was losing, on average, around $6 million a year. The signing of someone such as Hogan gave the company credibility it didn't previously have, and it took business to astronomical levels. For example, just in Hogan's first 6 or 7 months with the company, the 1994 Bash at the Beach did a buy rate of 1.02, Halloween Havoc did a buy rate of 1.0, and Uncensored of 1995 did a buy rate of 0.96. This trend continued with Hogan on top. If I can just use a few figures from 1996. Halloween Havoc of that year set a company record for first day ticket sales at the time of $94,000. In addition, Starrcade of 1996 did a 0.95 buy rate for Piper versus Hogan. By the end of 96, comparing it with the previous year's figures, that attendance was up 43% and gate revenues was up 87%. Now, the 1997 Starrcade match, which Mr. Chase mentioned there, did the company's biggest buy rate at 1.9 and drew $6 million in revenue for the company. And that was all part of a long-term plan from Mr. Bischoff. Now, they will point to creative control and criticise it and even roll their eyes and roll their head, maybe. But the fact is, it was not Mr. Bischoff solely responsible there. Ted Turner, who owned the company, acquiesced to Mr. Bischoff's request. He could have prevented this at any time, but chose not to. So I think to solely blame Bischoff for the contract, and they will say it's an unprecedented situation to offer someone that much leverage, shall we say, but we are dealing with what were unprecedented times.
All right, a few things there. You know, some nice points there, Carl. You mentioned some nice figures, but let's break that down a little bit. Yeah, we're talking short-term focus with long-term repercussions. When they brought Hogan in, it did do well for buy rates, again, in the short term. Once the Flair ones, once the Vader one was out of the way, Hogan didn't do anything for buy rates to the rest of 95 until the NWO came along, in which case, again, short-term business was very, very good for about a year and a half. Maybe a little bit longer than that. But the fact of the matter is, long-term, they were doomed, because as long as you had Hulk Hogan, as long as you had Hulk Hogan with a massive contract that you had to justify him being on television, you had to have Hogan there, and he had his creative control. And Hogan, using the Triple H precedent from the first trial, was only doing what wrestlers before him have done, what Hulk Hogan has always done, which is take care of number one. Hogan's not necessarily to blame for his decisions. The person who gave him that leverage is, and that was Eric Bischoff. You can point to Ted Turner all you like. Turner hired Bischoff as the WCW president, thinking that he was going to be the person that was going to make the right decisions for the company. It is not Turner's job to run WCW, it was Eric Bischoff's. Therefore, he's the person responsible in our eyes. Also, I will say again, in terms of Hulk Hogan always having to be on top because of the creative control, by the time Bischoff was done, he was back in the red and yellow, beating the tall heel with the boot and the leg drop. That's what we came to. As long as Hogan was there, he had to be the top guy, and that was not best for WCW in the long run.
With the signing of Hogan, 94, we can forget too easily the mainstream perception of WCW before that point. The signing of Hogan was instrumental in turning that company around. All the positives which the prosecution will claim today that Bischoff flitted away, although the responsibility of Bischoff may be argued, that environment was set by things that Bischoff did facilitate. In terms of the Hogan Sting deal, you say the Hogan contract allowed him to change the finish. The planned finish was, it's Sting Hogan Starrcade. Hogan, I think, hits the leg drop, covers Sting. Yeah. Tricky Nick Patrick, heel referee, was supposed to fast count 1, 2, 3. Bret Hart comes out, this bullshit's not happening, restart the match, Sting wins clean. That wasn't changed, that was the finish that was laid out. That was the finish that should have gone down. It didn't go down through execution. How you can blame Eric Bischoff for any of that, I have no idea. Bischoff didn't gain from that. It was his plan that got sabotaged. It was either incompetence in execution by Patrick, or it was a conspiracy by Hogan. How Bischoff gets involved in that, I have no idea. To that effect, we come back to Hogan being signed and the contract was in place. It was done in good faith, and that deal worked for, artistically you could argue, Hogan on top, but from 94 the company grew through 98 to its massive levels. That was only happened because of the deal with Hogan. I will still maintain that Bischoff, his key role within that company was a facilitator. Unfortunately, in that environment, and it wasn't just the deal, it was the whole corporate environment of WCW, of who's answerable to who. But to blame Bischoff for those instances, I think it's a long stretch.
So we've heard a lot about Hulk Hogan and Hogan's perceived role so far. I'd like to now move to the prosecution for the second point of evidence.
Okay, so we've talked about Hulk Hogan and wrestlers in creative positions, and no more telling example of a bad decision made by Eric Bischoff was the one to put Kevin Nash, Big Sexy, as the head booker of WCW from the end of 1998 to the end of Bischoff's run in 1999, a catastrophic reign that can only be described with the word negligent, in my opinion. From letting Kevin Nash be the guy to break Goldberg's streak at Starrcade, a hideous decision that had implications on WCW for years to come because Goldberg was supposed to be the man, this carried on over until the finger poke of doom, the catastrophic event on the January 4th, 1999 episode of Nitro. TV was absolutely fuck awful in 1999. Before Russo got there, it was terrible. TV ratings, let's talk about this. January of 1999, 3 of the 4 episodes of Nitro that ran that month did a 5.0 rating. By the time Kevin Nash was finished in August, they did a 2.9 for the August 23rd episode of Nitro. That is a massive, almost 50% decimation of their audience under Booker Big Kev. And the fact that Kevin Nash was even allowed in this position with no booking track record is completely ridiculous. He was put there for God knows what reason, but once he was there and he started to have that detrimental effect on the business and the ratings started to fall, and it was obvious the buy rates started to fall, the creative direction was not good. Bischoff knew that things were bad because he took desperate measures. We will get to that a little bit further down the road. The point is, he knew that Kevin Nash was not doing a sufficient job as the booker. He saw the ratings that he lived and died by week after week going downhill, and he did nothing to stop it. He didn't remove Kevin Nash at the time. Why he put Nash there, in my opinion, is completely negligent just from the get-go. Engelberg streak. Book a fucking horrible angle in the finger poke of doom, and then kill television with this absolutely dreadful writing that helped no one, elevated no one the entire time that he was the booker, ratings and buy rates eroded and left by the time Bischoff was gone. I would argue, and so would Mr. Chase, left WCW in an extremely unenviable and unrecoverable position.
Okay. I will start with your final point, that he left, Eric Bischoff left WCW.
An unrecoverable
position.
Yeah.
Okay, Eric Bischoff's final Monday night, unopposed, I can't remember where Raw was preempted, it did a 4 rating. You say, unopposed, you say that's a baseline of your audience. It's a fair assumption to make. That's not a company in an unrecoverable position. A 4 rating is not an unrecoverable position. It's a hell of a fan base to work from.
Yes. As a counter argument to that, just before we get into your next point, just because they did 4.0 uncontested for the casual audience on television does not necessarily mean that they're in a position that's really going to advance anything, because buy rates and live attendance have completely been shot by then, and you can't turn that around like that just because the dog show's on.
Go for it. If I can just jump in there quickly, we're not suggesting that this 4.0 rating is sort of the silver bullet, if you like. Merely the fact that there are enough eyeballs on the product, there is enough intrigue, there is enough interest there, that there is a base to build from again. So to our mind, that does not mean the company was in an unrecoverable position.
Yeah, absolutely, there's a foundation there. Now, right, on to the major point, which is Kevin Nash.
I like you see it. Come on, defend Nash's booking.
I don't have to defend Nash's booking because Nash isn't on trial. Eric Bischoff is.
Yeah, and he's the one that put him there.
He did. And was that a good or bad choice? It was a bad choice. No doubt about it. But it didn't kill the company at that time. It was changed before the company was in absolute dire straits 2 years later. This, we were talking about before, about Bischoff being a facilitator. Not a booker, not an overall creative direction kind of guy. They had been extraordinarily successful with the NWO angle, with Nash, Hogan et al, for 3 years, making crazy money which the wrestling industry couldn't even dreamt of previously. He gave the book to a guy in Nash who was instrumental with coming up with ideas. The decision to put Nash in a formal position of power, it was a gamble, it was a risk, but it was done in good faith, and given the numbers that they were responsible for the previous 2 years, you could understand where the thought is coming from. Yes, that was a wrong move, but the minutiae of what went on those shows was Kevin Nash. And you got to remember, this we're in the war at this stage. We're in the trenches, 10 feet away from WEF. In this 3 year period, the whole industry changed so much, and I think this is something we forget, that the Vince Russo school of booking, hot shot in, throwing shit against the wall, it came from this period when there was two companies going back and forth, and Russo never really understood that. Bearing that in mind, that environment when Eric Bischoff is looking for ideas, Bischoff is willing to try things. Yeah, he tried Nash and it failed, but the incompetence of the booking is surely Kevin Nash and not Eric Bischoff.
Yeah, you were just stating there about like competing with WWF in the Monday Night Wars, and you described it as being in the trenches. Pretty certain, like, if a guy who's in the trenches fighting for, you know, survival with the product, I'm certain someone who was competent in their role, they would not go on holiday during this time and leave Nash alone as the booker.
Especially during a time when Kevin Nash had cut ratings so significantly. You can point to a 4.0 and you're giggling off microphone, judge, I want it to be noted, because he knows the way it is. The fact of the matter is he damaged ratings so badly that he decided, hey, you know what, I'm going to leave this guy in charge and go fly fishing.
No one is suggesting that Eric Bischoff didn't make mistakes.
Good!
That's not the point we're making here. Was there a level of naivety involved? Perhaps. But I would argue the case where they talk about sort of responsibility, that Eric Bischoff paid the ultimate responsibility in the end by the fact that he was let go in September of that year.
And rightfully so.
When Harvey Schiller,
yep.
Bearing in mind, I just want to point that out, he was reporting to Harvey Schiller, president of Turner Sports, let Eric Bischoff go. So Eric Bischoff already paid the price for that.
Yeah.
And yet you are trying to try him again.
No, no, no. We're trying out eight. He was fired on the charge of doing a poor job, correct?
He was, absolutely. He was fired. He was fired for the period. He had paid the price. But because the prosecution isn't happy with that alone, they are now trying to move the goalposts.
There's a difference between moving goalposts at the time when it actually happened, when Dr. Harvey Schiller did fire Eric Bischoff, you're correct. However, the implications were much more than just what happened in 1999. It extended for the next 2 years, and we will get to those points shortly.
We absolutely will, but I would like to point out there that, as you have acknowledged, Bischoff was gone in 99. September of that year.
Came back in 2000, though, didn't he?
For a three-month period.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that.
Okay, gentlemen. Does anyone have anything else to add on finger pokes or fly fishing?
No, that's it for us.
At this stage, I'd like to look to try and bring some of our expert witnesses. So from our feedback, I'd like to start firstly with some points made by Smelly Meatball from TPWD Forums, who says, would argue that Hogan or the AOL Time Warner merger were bigger reasons in the end. Hogan mostly because of the vast amount of politicking he did, while the merger eventually led to a new boss at the time who wanted nothing to do with wrestling. Bischoff's main problems were relying too much on the NWO storyline and wanting to spend his way out of a situation, good or bad, then develop it for the long term. He did kill off WCW, but he wasn't the main guy responsible.
Hulk Hogan's creative. You mentioned Hogan there as a point of blame. Again, I think that does go back to Eric Bischoff, because he's the one that allowed Hulk Hogan to do that in the first place. If it wasn't for Eric Bischoff, Hulk Hogan doesn't do that damage. I want to get to this point right now about Jamie Kellner and the AOL Time Warner merger, because I know there's a lot more of this, Matt. So if you want to actually read a couple more of these AOL Time Warner merger points off for the people defending Bischoff, please do.
Malachi from the Wrestling Forum says, I vote not guilty on the basis that the AOL Time Warner merger was what truly killed the company. A lot of times when bad decisions are made, it was simply Bischoff following orders from those higher than him, such as Turner. Not to say that Bischoff didn't make some bonehead choices, but I feel the majority blame should not be on his shoulders. Destor from TPWW Forum says, considering that the only reason WCW died was because Bischoff couldn't get a slight time slot at the time of its collapse, and its ratings were still strong compared to other cable programming, the answer is no. The only blame here is the AOL merger. Gary Thompson says, is he not from anywhere? Which fucking meet him outside by Home Bargains or something?
He's Gary Thompson from the internet.
Gary Thompson said, the real bad guy here was the AOL Time Warner merger. Basically, it was all fine in 95-96 when the merger was done, but fast forward a few years and the network execs wanted rid of wrestling programming no matter what, because they hated it. So, even if WCW's ratings for Nitro were the 5.0 average consistently, and Thunder ratings were solid, the execs were always going to can any wrestling show on their network. So you could blame Bischoff, Hogan, or Russo, but like I said, in my opinion, there are bigger culprits than Eric Bischoff.
Thank you very much, Ivana, for reading those expert witness testimony, as you put it. This whole thing about the AOL Time Warner merger has pissed me off for years, because the whole thing about this whole case, and even from the defense's standpoint, is that they love this whole shifting of responsibility, the blame game that was all too apparent in World Championship Wrestling at the time, from what I understand. The whole idea that because of Jamie Kellner, because of a network executive who hated wrestling and had a predisposition to hating the wrestling business, they cancelled the TV and therefore it's all fucked. It's a very one-dimensional, one-sided view of the world. The reason why Jamie Kellner killed it, okay, he didn't like wrestling, but it had a terrible stigma. WCW was a money pit. It lost $15 million in 1999. We'll get to this later on, Your Honor. $15 million losses in 1999, which Bischoff was a massive part of. It lost $67 million in 2000, which Eric Bischoff was also a part of. The ratings, he said there, Gary Thompson made the point that if they did a 5.0 every week, they still would have cancelled it. We don't know that. It's a completely hypothetical situation. They weren't doing 5.0s at the time they cancelled it. They weren't a profitable company when they cancelled it. The reason WCW died, if WCW was such hot shit and WCW was in such a good position and it was just one guy's decision, then when Eric Bischoff was going around in the final days of the Fusion Media deal trying to get on another network, somebody would have snapped them up, because they would have looked at 5.0 ratings in the competitive television market and they would have signed WCW up to put them on their network. Nobody wanted to do it. We talked about this on the Invasion show 2 weeks ago, that when WWF bought WCW, TNN didn't even want a WCW show on the air, even under Vince McMahon's vision. The whole idea that it's one person's responsibility and that Jamie Kellner's the person to blame is completely ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. There are reasons why that decision was made, and yes, he did not like wrestling. It's very well known they didn't like wrestling, but had the company of WCW still been making $250 million like they were in 1998, had they still been doing the 5.0 ratings they did in January of 1999, then it would have been a hell of a lot harder for him to convince the people around him to ditch a company that was generating that much revenue.
Okay then, so before we pass back over to the defence, I'd like to quickly bring some more of the feedback to the forum, and this is Mifune Jackson from the Wrestling Forum says, where exactly is Time Warner responsible for a lot of the poor writing we saw on TV, like the Hummer angle, which predates Russo? That's why I think the Time Warner ruined everything has always been a tough sell for me. Bischoff was in charge when Starrcade 97 was botched, when the streak ended, when he hot-shotted matches with screwy finishes constantly, and basically doing everything he could, unwittingly so, to ruin Sting, Goldberg, and Flair's drawing ability. For the defence.
Hear, hear.
It is true that had the company been profitable, I don't believe that Mr. Kellner would have cancelled it. I'm not going to try and hoodwink the judge or any of the listeners. But I would say that it does speak to a wider point which we on the defence have referred to before. The prosecution want to paint this in very black and white terms. And it is a much more murky, much more sort of muddied, watered situation, if you will. Eric Bischoff's hands are very much tied in what he can and can't do. There was talk of the losses there. Now, no one is disputing that in 99, 2000 and 2001, the company lost money. He wasn't the accountant. There were others who should have been managing the books. They had accountants at Time Warner. They could have reined the purse strings in at any stage they wished, as is evident by the fact that in August of 2000, Mr. Russo was informed of dramatically reduced budgets, which I don't think the prosecution will argue.
No, would not argue that.
So the point is, there were other people who could have reined in the spending at any time, other than Mr. Bischoff, who could have reduced the losses. So to try and pin that on Mr. Bischoff, especially during significant portions of time when he is not there. So there were significant losses, given the time frame in which Mr. Bischoff was there during those losses. I think it is completely inappropriate to try and sort of funnel and push all the blame onto him.
It was all the contracts that Eric Bischoff had signed. It's all the expenditures on outside talent coming into the company. It's just random funds that he was using, whether it was just freaking for dinner or the stages and settings that they didn't end up using. It was Eric Bischoff that put them in dire straits anyway in 99 to the point where they had to cut their losses in 2000. You know, it's all the expenditures that he brought up in there. So yeah, of course they had to cut the losses because already WCW was on the downward spiral before anyone else was put in charge.
But is it really Bischoff's fault that the accountants didn't bother to check and do that until August of the following year?
I think just to supplement that point is, what was the profit last year before that? I think the profit was around, it was 50 to 60, which would, over that 2 year period, would put them $35-45 million a profit over those 2 years. Make no mistake, WCW didn't go bankrupt. Bankruptcy didn't kill WCW. We must bear in mind that the tools that Bischoff had in his position were very different to the tools that, say, Vince McMahon had into the 97, 98, 99. The risque Attitude Era stuff was stuff that Bischoff was not allowed to do on his networks. That was a weapon WWF could use because of the organisational structure of the company. The organisational structure of WCW allowed for a $15 million loss in 99.
Just as a counterpoint there, we've never actually said that year was the reason WCW died, the $15 million losses. We've never made that assertion. That will tie into something on our next point that we'll get to. The point that Kieran just made about the WWF having access to tools like going in the hardcore, more edgy route that it did, well, that's all well and good to say. Maybe WCW didn't have that leeway. However, that never stopped WCW before, because in 1993 and 94, they had the same restrictions cast down on them. They couldn't even say the word foreign object. They had to call it an international object, for Christ's sake. They couldn't use blood. They had these restrictions the entire time, but they still managed to be successful at one point, extremely successful, as you've done a great job pointing out. So I think that trying to use that as a defense of Bischoff's product here in this show is kind of a moot point. With the judges, permission, can I move on to the third point, because we're actually kind of talking about it right now, the contract and spending. Is that okay, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Okay. Malpractice is what I would judge this as, this whole contract and spending. I'm just going to rattle off a few numbers here. Paying Stevie Ray $750,000 a year Did anybody ever buy a ticket to an episode of Nitro or watch a pay-per-view and feel they got their money's worth from the Stevie Ray match? The answer's no. Scott Norton on $800,000 a year. I don't know anything that Scott Norton could possibly have done rather than maybe save Bischoff's children that would be worth that amount of money. Swole!
Oh, fuck.
From the No Limit Soldiers. $400,000. Anybody remember anything Swole did? He never wrestled a match. Maybe most well-known 4x4 in the illustrious Harlem Heat 2000. They spent $500,000 for the Kiss concert that Kieran mentioned, which did a 2.25 quarter hour rating. Money well spent there. Master P, $200,000 per appearance. Dennis Rodman, $200,000 per appearance. They spent $100,000 on that fucking junkyard battle royal at Bash at the Beach 99, if anybody remembers that abortion of a match. They spent $150,000 on Lanny Poffo, who never appeared on TV. $300,000 on a set for WCW Latino, a show that never even aired, because they ended up just playing tapes of Nitro in the time slot that they got. All of this was reckless spending, yes. Maybe it is the accountant's responsibility. However, the reason that those losses took place in the first place is because they were projected from the year before to do a certain level of business. And these decisions, along with these ridiculous expenditures, led to the pay-per-view buy rates and the house show attendance to plummet, so they couldn't make the money that they were supposed to generate in order to cover these costs in the first place. And that's not something that you can necessarily call out ahead of time. Now, Bischoff was not in charge for all of 1999, so there is a little bit of leeway there. Russo did a terrible job with a bad hand. No one's going to argue that, but the contract that Bischoff signed still existed during this period of time, and as the ratings and the numbers plummeted, the sins of 1997, 98, and 99 from a contract standpoint bled over because it was short-term focused. They thought they were going to make that money forever. That $250 million of revenue, they treated it like they were going to be able to do that forever, which is completely unrealistic. They did treat all these guys like they were going to be stars forever, and as things turned around and how quickly they turned around, the contracts that may have seemed fair at the time were quickly, very, very quickly revealed to be ridiculous. Bischoff was there. You mentioned the date when the budget came in September 2000. You mentioned that the short term that Bischoff had in 2000, that was Bischoff's time. When they came in to cut the budget in 2000, it was directly after Eric Bischoff had left. So to try and...
But who was more present during most of that period of time? Would that be Vince Russo?
On air, certainly.
And not creatively as well?
They were both in that position.
Okay, so there's more than one hand there.
Absolutely.
Mr. Russo is also present. There was a key... it may seem like a throwaway word there, Judge, but it was used a couple of times. They projected. They thought these revenues were coming forever. It may seem innocuous, but it's key, because it's not the individual. It's not solely Bischoff. As we have said before, and I feel I must belabor this point because it's so crucial, Eric Bischoff was not the accountant. He had to provide those projections to the higher-ups. Surely the culpability for not scrutinizing them further rests with the higher-ups and not Eric Bischoff. All of these things, yes, Eric Bischoff gave creative control to certain contracts. Yes, he spent money, but it was money that he was allowed to spend by people above him who could have prevented if they so wished. Kieran, would you like to add anything there?
In terms of the contracts which you talk about now, they were at the start a necessary evil. We can look back in hindsight and say, there was an inevitability to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fair point to state that with those big money contracts, at least with the main stars, obviously had their benefits on initial stage, and that they were a necessary evil because he had to bring in big stars in order to increase ratings. But to continue paying these stars these high wages, and then to pay, even if they, in comparison, small sums to lower card guys who didn't draw a frickin' dime and weren't there to, increase the product in terms of its potential or, its money-making abilities. It's just stupid. And it was just so much money being spent on people that really weren't worth it.
On the subject of what we've just talking about, Impeccable from TPWW Forums actually makes some great points summing up. With Bischoff, I'm not sure what else he was supposed to do. He was tasked with making WCW compete with a juggernaut. The only way he could do that was to sign top guys with what he believed was a blank checkbook. In order to make them come, he had to promise guaranteed megabucks contracts and also give creative control. He had to do that to sign them, and with those guys came egos and baggage. To compete, he needed them, and he needed them happy, and he had to pander to their needs to the detriment of the rest of the business. He goes on to say that had Eric's brief been to create a stable, financially well-run company, creating stars and becoming sustainable, I'm sure he had the skills to have done so, but that was not his brief. Ted wanted to compete and nothing more. We see in other sports teams that can sink cash into trying to compete and then self-imploding later.
Yeah, it's absolutely right at the end of the day. Who's, you know, what master is he serving? What do the paymaster want? Is it a vanity project for Turner? Bang on the money, in my opinion.
Mr. Turner clearly said to Bischoff in his meeting that what have we got to do to compete with the WWE?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think Andy Howitt also joins the defence by saying, if you want to blame one man, then it's Ted Turner, because he was the one who was boss, and it's him putting people in the wrong jobs, and he subsidises the losses that were made by Bischoff, Russo and co. WWE rarely ever made a profit during the Turner years.
So that's another fantastic point, because the one, in my honest opinion, away from this court case right now, the probably the biggest charge you could say how Eric Bischoff may be responsible for the death of WCW would be the starting of the proper war. As I alluded to before, it's once you start a war, there's going to be a victim. And when they didn't kill off WWF in 97, it was maybe it was a matter of time, one way or the other, who knows. So my gut feeling is maybe that's the biggest charge that the prosecution could have thrown at Bischoff. But at the same time, as it has been rightly brought up now, it was actually the pressure from Turner, and then Bischoff basically acquiescing to Turner's requests in order to try and, you know, keep his own job. So I maybe can't even lay that fully at the feet of Bischoff.
Okay, I want to read a piece of feedback now, some more expert testimonial from Promoter 2003 from the Wrestling Forum. I'm in the guilty camp. I know the merger was the nail in the coffin, but believe that WCW was screwed up long before that happened. Bischoff got too damn cocky by late 97, especially when Bret Hart jumped. Bischoff and WCW had Vince by the balls and they screwed it up. Revisionist history by the WWE is not fooling me. I saw this history live. Look how long WCW was beating WWF for, even with Austin rising. WCW had a better roster and it forced Russo and McMahon to throw things against the wall and against normal practice, and they were still losing. It was no accident once screwing up Sting, Hart, Goldberg, along with letting the NWO run on too long, that fans started to flee from WCW. The WWE picked up some of those disgruntled fans in 1999 and 2000, but overall the boom was over once WCW no longer started to compete. If Bischoff didn't start screwing things up so badly, no way WCW believes that it could turn around by hiring Russo. Bischoff gets all the praise for igniting the 90s boom, but he also has to take the blame for some of the boom becoming a bust too. The big difference was that Vince never truly became so egotistical that all he wanted to do was wipe out the NWA and the AWA. Vince was building long term to expand his organisation, and Bischoff was only concerned about beating Raw.
Agree completely. It's sorry, I'd say that to rile Carl up, because I know he couldn't disagree more with some of that statement. His point, his overriding point, I agree completely. Creatively, and this is something that we should get into now, I suppose, Goldberg was killed, Bret was dead, he'd floundered, he'd done nothing for 2 years, what are you going to do with him? They completely scorched the earth with a lot of the tools that would have been used to help recover things, and that's actually something we're going to get onto on our next point.
And with that fourth and final point in mind, let's move back to the prosecution for their fourth point. Gentlemen?
Yes, our fourth point is, as stated in the opening, is going to be the failure of Eric Bischoff creating any new stars during his tenure. The defence has already gone into the fact about they think that due to the figures that WCW could have been turned around, that it wasn't just too late. Well, I put it to you that because no stars were built, and anyone in the roster that was already there had already been burnt out, that they had such limited resources, there was no way they could bring it back up. When you look at the failure to bring up new stars, you know, I've already mentioned Sting and what happened to him, you know, like after that Starrcade 97 debacle, it was, yeah, he was done. It was very hard for him. You know, he still got crowd reactions, but, you know, no difference maker at all. When you look at Goldberg, which we've already been over, Goldberg, they were pushing to the moon, and then, you know, Eric Bischoff put Kevin Nash as the booker, and so Kevin Nash killed Goldberg. You also look towards, like, you know, the mid-card, whether it was, you know, Raven or Benoit, Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, and so on. When you look at all those guys were having consistently good matches on every show, right? And they were popular with the audience. But Bischoff failed to push any of these guys to the point where a lot of these people ended up leaving the company. If you take Jericho and Point, they built up a storyline with Jericho to face off against Goldberg, and they built it and built it and built it, and when time came to pass, it didn't happen. You know, Goldberg, you know, stepped in and said he didn't want to do it, but, you know, Bischoff was in charge of this. Bischoff did not handle the situation well, and because of that, Jericho got fed up and he jumped ship to WWF, where he became a success. Other wrestlers, if you look down the list towards luchadors in the cruiserweight division, all of them were buried as well. Pretty much all of the main luchadors that were popular lost their masks. All of them lost their identities in some way, and in particular Rey Mysterio. You know, it was Eric Bischoff's decision to take the mask off Rey Mysterio because he thought he was more marketable without the mask, which is bullshit when you look at the current situation that WWF did with Rey Mysterio when they brought him in and the amount of masks they sold. There were so many people on that roster. There were so many opportunities that Eric Bischoff had to build stars for the future, and he did have time to do it. He certainly had 96, 97, and 98 to build these stars, but he hadn't. The only people who did get pushes all got the rug pulled from underneath them. So by the time it did end Eric Bischoff's tenure in late 1999, and Eric Bischoff, Vince Russo, sorry, came in and took control, he had nobody. He had a roster that was either already being buried, were fed up and weren't given the opportunities, or were being held back by backstage politics by guys who had influence over their own booking.
To backtrack slightly to one of the emailers there, because Bret Hart's name was mentioned. Now, in the interest of Bret Hart, by his own admission, was never fully on board. His heart was never in it. He said himself at the end of his documentary, which was filmed throughout 97, tenuring his final days with the WWF, that company basically put a gun to the head of the Hitman character and blew his brains out. So Bret Hart was damaged goods before he got to WCW. Let's not try and suggest otherwise. Let's not try and suggest that he was wholly on board and all ready to go. He wasn't. He was sulking.
Just to now, go in there very brief, and I'm going to give this back to you, but I just want to object to that little point there. Even if Bret Hart's heart wasn't in it, to suggest that Bret was damaged goods when he was the biggest star in Canada, in either company at the time, he could have meant a significant difference, and they completely wasted Bret Hart.
He was one of the hottest prospects around in terms of just, you know, he was the guy that everybody was talking about. Yeah, Red Hot when he came in. And yet, what did they do with him when he came in Starrcade? Instead of giving him an actual match or building an angle for him to go into, they just did two freaking referee spots.
And it speaks to his lack of disinterest that he didn't kick up a stink about it, frankly. Now, with regards to the other talent, I will accept that a lot of talent there possibly weren't treated in the manner they should have been. Chris Jericho did get upset with the Goldberg situation, but I don't recall Jericho ever being promised a match with Goldberg. I don't remember there being any promises of a long-term program with Goldberg. With regards to Rey Mysterio, yes, the decision to have him take away to lose the mask was a bad decision. Won't argue that. The point I will make is that the proposition was made to Rey Mysterio 18 months, that give or take. I will, you know, forgive me for not being completely on track with the chronology of it, but he was offered the opportunity to remove the mask in 97 in his match with Eddie Guerrero, and he and Guerrero fought against it. In 99, he acquiesced. He accepted it. He accepted it because he thought it would benefit his career. Now, names such as Malenko, Saturn, and Benoit were also mentioned there. Now, again, were they treated as well as they should have been? Possibly not. I would argue that there is a strong case to be made that the likes of Malenko and Benoit wouldn't have turned the business around for their inability to work the stick, so to speak. But the reason for their departure from the company can be traced partly to that, but also in the isolated incident of Kevin Sullivan and Benoit's own poor life choices, which meant that when Sullivan was put in charge, when Bischoff was nowhere on the scene, he and many other wrestlers decided they wanted to leave. Yes, was some necessarily treated as well as they should have been? Possibly not. Is Bischoff responsible for all of them leaving? No. And Bischoff should be given credit for giving them a national platform in the first place when the World Wrestling Federation were not interested in them.
I think maybe a little realism to what was going on at the time in terms of the elevation of new talent. Did guys get buried? Absolutely. Guys I personally liked and wanted to see elevated, like Chris Jericho, never became what they should have in WCW. Absolutely, will not disagree with that. That didn't kill the company. And the reason why those who made the decisions could justify a status quo is that because 96 was bigger than 95 and 97 was bigger than 96, 98 was bigger than 97, year on year business was actually increasing. So while we all want a fantasy book and see Chris Benoit maybe do a diving headbutt on Hulk Hogan at Starcade, I don't know, it gives a fuck. They were making money through those years still, so it's understandable why they didn't change up and massively alter the formula. And I will, no, should they have elevated guys, more guys throughout that period? Yeah, absolutely, but there was still an opportunity to do it after Bischoff left in 99. Goldberg, slightly different circumstances, but again, to put the failure on Bischoff, I think it's very harsh and it's not fair. When the decision to put Goldberg over Hogan, although understandably you could argue it was a short-term decision, lost out on pay-per-view revenue, we've got to go back to the masters that Bischoff serving as the head of a professional wrestling company owned by a TV conglomerate.
Okay, well, this is I've waited patiently, Your Honor. Here, Carl and Kieran have had their say.
First time for everything.
They've done a good job. Yeah. However, they've kind of muddied the waters here intentionally, I feel, to steer away from the actual point as it was, which is that the future of the company was eviscerated during that period under Eric Bischoff. Because you can say all you want that, okay, after Bischoff was gone, there was ample chance there. There was time. But the casual audience had been almost completely eviscerated by the time that Bischoff had left. And casuals are what you need to hook. If they're not watching, it's hard to make a star. They did do a good job with Goldberg. They did a fantastic job. They made Goldberg, and then they pretty much killed his drawing power. They eviscerated. Okay, listen to the guys. Goldberg eviscerated. Raven was so happy with the company that he was asked to walk out by Eric Bischoff, and he did. Chris Jericho, again, you said the whole thing about Goldberg not wanting to work with him. This is another thing, ties into Bischoff's lack of leadership. How are these guys like Goldberg allowed to refuse angles? They had no creative control in their contract. He let guys walk all over him.
If I can just... I just want to ask you a question in relation to that, if that's okay. Was Jericho ever promised a fully-fledged program with Goldberg?
Doesn't matter. Because to be quite honest, if you've got something that looks like it's going to work, and it did look like it was going to work, it wasn't an obvious thing that, hey, Goldberg's not working with anybody at World War III. Chris Jericho lobbied for it. I've got some heat. I've got something going here. It doesn't matter if he's promised it. It's the direction to obviously go, and they didn't do it.
But to the point of him being dissatisfied with the company and choosing to leave, if he wasn't given promises and assurances of that, then really what right has he got to gripe?
The fact that he wanted upward mobility.
Well, there are plenty of things that we want that we don't necessarily get.
Of course, but there's one thing to want upward mobility, and there's another one thing to craft it and make it obvious that that's the right thing to happen, and for the company to say, no, you're going to back off. Rey Mysterio, you mentioned before, him and Eddie Guerrero stuck together so he wouldn't have to lose his mask. The reason he did, you neglected to mention, was because Eric Bischoff promised him a push that he didn't give him after he lost the mask. They pretty much eviscerated Rey Mysterio's drawing power by taking away the mask's potential drawing power, and then actually gave him absolutely nothing in return. Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero both asked for contract releases under Eric Bischoff, which led to the famous Eric Bischoff throwing hissy fit and throwing coffee at Eddie Guerrero in an extremely professional manner backstage, may I add. They threw away the future of the company. Again, short-term decisions with long-term ramifications. Raven, Jericho, they're guys in the middle. They'll do great in the middle. Benoit, Guerrero, you do great in the middle. These guys that you mentioned, like all these big contracts, Nash, Hogan, Piper, Savage, they had a lifespan on them. They were always going to burn out because it always does. Wrestling is a constantly evolving wheel, and when Bischoff didn't want to evolve the wheel, and it wasn't like there weren't signs that things were falling apart, because like I said, the ratings from January to August were falling constantly, the buy rates were falling constantly. They didn't change tact near the end of Bischoff's run. They stuck, like I said, Hulk Hogan in the red and yellow with a big boot and the leg over Kevin Nash at Road Wild. They didn't change direction. They stuck with the pat hand, even when it was obvious that that wasn't the way to go. And when you've got guys like Raven walking out, like Guerrero and Benoit asking for releases, like Jericho making his mind up months before, almost a year before he went to the WWF, that he was going to go there because he saw there's no upward mobility in the company. Mysterio gets his balls cut off, Bret Hart gets killed as a draw, and the one guy that they managed to make successfully, Bill Goldberg, they fucked it up 6 months later. That did hurt the company. To say that it didn't, and to say that, oh well, that whole mid-card thing, it's all a mishmash, that it didn't hurt the company. Yes, it did, because in 2000, they would have killed for a guy that was a new star as hot as Goldberg was in 98, but they didn't jump on it when they had the chance. And, because I do want to get this in, Eric Bischoff, on Sunday Night Submission in 2006, a show near and dear to your heart and mine, Carl, was there a problem with me elevating those guys? You know, I gotta be honest with you, no. I don't think I really made a mistake. To be blunt and brutal about it, we gave Benoit, Guerrero, and Jericho a national platform, and they did very well. Were they ready to carry a main event spot? I don't think so. That may have been his opinion at the time. It's clearly his opinion now. His mentality hasn't changed, but numbers suggest otherwise. And that, to us, is negligence.
But do you have metrics to hand which clearly show during their time in WCW, not talking about what they would go on to do in the future, do you have metrics that show that they clearly would have made a discernible difference? Can you say categorically that those individuals would have?
Can you ever prove that unless they're put in the spot?
The burden of proof does sit with the prosecution.
And I feel that the fact that the numbers went down when he stuck the course pretty much proves that they needed something new.
I will just say one thing. There was a sort of an accusation there that we are disingenuously attempting to muddy the waters. I don't think that's some sort of deliberate tactic just for the sake of it. I think what we are demonstrating is the fact that this is clearly not the black and white situation the prosecution is claiming. There are shades of grey involved, and we are dealing with what is a very murky, very entangled situation, as some witnesses have clearly made reference to, the amount of red tape and bureaucracy involved. So we are merely trying to give a full picture of the messiness of the situation, if you like.
A very, very quick question for the defence, because and as you sip that beer, I want you to kind of get through all that alcohol and get some a bit of clarity in that brain there, Carl. I find this beer drinking in court to be unprofessional, Your Honour. I would also just like to point out...
Objection! My drinking or lack thereof is not on trial here.
Okay, very quickly, you mentioned the whole thing about, you know, responsibility, muddy waters. Let's get some clarity then, because you're saying that Bischoff's not the person most responsible. We said at the very beginning, you know, we're thinking that percentage-wise, Bischoff's most responsible. Where does the blame lie in your opinion then?
Predominantly?
No. We're not here to accuse or prosecute anyone. We're here to defend Eric Bischoff.
And that, listeners and Your Honour, is why Mr. Kieran O'Rourke, QC, is the team captain.
Good job. Couple more pieces of feedback I'd like to come to before we come back round for closing arguments then. Dooley from Pro Wrestling Only touched on a few points that people have made so far during the case. Only Hogan had creative control. The rest of the upper card just refused to do things because Eric allowed it. Yeah. Very interesting point. As for guaranteed contracts, they may not have been his initial idea, but Eric clearly didn't have a problem with it and embraced the system. He was routinely criticised for pushing guys to their contract, i.e. big contract, bid push, mid-level contract, mid-level push. Jericho talked about it in his book, and since he was the one making the offers, it's hard not to hold Bischoff responsible in that regard.
Completely agree.
A couple of pieces of neutral feedback here. Herbsky from the Pro Wrestling Forum said, "Most businesses don't willingly lose money just because they like wrestling. WCW was lucky to have a guy like Turner who didn't seem to care whether WCW made money or not. And maybe in some ways he was lucky because of his hiring choices, but at least with Ted, his money was always going to keep it afloat as long as he wanted it to. Aol did not like wrestling, but money talked, and if it were making money, I'm pretty sure it would have been kept. So, coming back to the earlier point about the merger, Herbsky thinks the merger did not kill WCW, losing money killed WCW. Moving over to the UK fan forum, Ian Drew Dice Clay says, "When he got in trouble in 98-99, it probably showed Bischoff up in a lot of ways. He threw money at problems and it put them in a horrible position, paying Kiss, Megadeth, Rodman, Chuck Zito, Chad Brock and all of these other celebs millions and getting zero back in return in the space of 6 weeks was a horrendous mistake. It literally was the midlife crisis era of Nitro. DJ Ram were on it every week. Tony Schiavone began wearing a leather jacket and gelling his hair. Hulk Hogan started dressing like Shifty Shellshock, and instead of removing the elements everyone was sick of, they tried polishing a turd by repackaging it for people who didn't fit. The thing that was ultimate kills Bischoff is that he was the only one who signed off on Goldberg getting beat. They sold out the Georgia Dome with only Goldberg announced in late 98, and so they decided to beat him a week before. Not only that, at the Georgia Dome in front of Goldberg's hometown fans, they had NWO slap him about. They strangely then paid for the Atlanta Falcons to come out after the show went off air instead of doing something on the show with their biggest star."
Yeah, it would have been nice, wouldn't it, in front of all those people to do something good with your potential top babyface star.
They're just trying to build heat on the heels, Liam, which, as you will acknowledge yourself, is a vital part of a wrestling storyline.
And they did such a great job with the follow-through, didn't they, under Booker Kev. Fantastic job. Nash decision that Bischoff signed off on.
Sticking with the UK fan forum, let's go over to Tiger Rick. He's responsible for their decline in 98 and 99, but when he left in 99, WCW was alive and well. They then caught the fact they called him back in April 2000 speaks volumes. Bischoff is culpable, but should be offset against the fact that without him, there would be no success. No boom before the bust. Gentlemen of the defence and of the prosecution, you have covered various points well. Now is your opportunity to sum up before judge and jury, both being me, your closing arguments. Think long, think hard for a second before you give it, because this is going to be the culmination of your points this evening and what I will largely base my judgment on. Firstly, for the prosecution.
Thank you, Your Honour. Over the course of the past hour and a half, we've talked about a lot of different elements in World Championship Wrestling. Hulk Hogan, the contract that ended up dooming them in the sense that they always had to build around Hogan. Bischoff's decision to sign that contract. Bischoff's decision to anoint Kevin Nash the Booker and keep him there despite falling buy rates, falling ratings, and not changing course. Ridiculous spending that, yes, did not individually kill the company but led to a spiral effect. They lost $15 million in 1999. They ended up losing $67 million in 2000. Yes, as they've said, losing the money itself did not kill WCW. They didn't, you know, they didn't go out of business because they were short on funds. They lost because they were a money pit that the parent company looked at and said, we don't want this anymore. The reason the money was that high in terms of losses was the contracts and expenditures that Bischoff set in place throughout that period of success that they were talking about, 97, 98, 99. From a financial standpoint, again, those losses that we just talked about didn't kill the company. It also tainted the WCW name to the point where when a guy like Jamie Kellner could come in and pull the plug, there was no opposition within the company to do it, and there was no other outside forces or stations to help WCW and give them a life raft, because the WCW brand was associated with failure because of what happened primarily in Bischoff's run. Yes, he's not the only person responsible for the stigma on WCW, but he is the most responsible, because all the things that took place in a creative situation in terms of not building new stars, relying on the Pat Hand, killing Goldberg, killing Brett, killing difference makers for his company. The guys that had made a difference, their difference had been made by 1998. Hogan wasn't going to mean any more, and he clearly didn't, because he was done as a current act until his nostalgia retread run, which, by the way, was very short-lived in the WWF. Those guys weren't going to make the difference. The future was. Jericho went to the WWF and became a star. Benoit became a star. Guerrero became a star that moved numbers. Goldberg should have been a guy that meant a difference for years to come. Let's look at the blame game that's being played here. The AOL Time Warner merger, we've mentioned before how Kellner wouldn't have cut the company if it was doing as well as it already was. The whole argument that the suits over Bischoff, that the chain of command somehow fucked with this. How? The fact that WCW was such a piss-poor run company from the inside, from an organizational perspective, is a lot of what did the damage. The stories of Nitro being rewritten while the show is on the air itself is legendary, because Bischoff, who instead of having his eye on the ball, instead of looking over Kevin Nash and micromanaging a company this big, he was fly fishing in Wyoming, he's riding on his bikes in Sturgis, and he's at Loose Lips Night at the Gold Club. The fact of the matter is Bischoff should have been on the ball and wasn't. He didn't see the sign of the times, he didn't see that things were changing, he didn't see that new stars were needed. He continued to throw billionaires' money around like water to buy people like Kiss and Megadeth that meant absolutely nothing for anything. Could it have been saved? I feel, after Bischoff was done, the answer is no. Not only from a financial perspective, because the money was spiraling out of control and continued to, because they couldn't recover the money they were spending, but they lost the casual fans. By the time Bischoff was done, we mentioned, okay, you can point to a 4.0 rating, and I'm sure there were numbers that were in that ballpark on unopposed nights, but head-to-head, when you get into a 2.9 in the middle of August or late August, that's a pretty bad sign. Russo did steer the boat to the bottom of the ocean in many ways. Bischoff's the one that crashed it so that no one else could drive it. And that's the key point. In closing here, we've summed up everything that I feel Bischoff is responsible for. A quote from Eric Bischoff's own book where he says, "Managing success is sometimes much more difficult than creating it in the first place." There is no doubt that Bischoff's the one that signed the Hogan contract. Kieran said himself, no doubt it was a bad decision in regards to Nash as the Booker. Complete culpability on Kevin Nash and Eric Bischoff for making a bad decision there. The spending that they said, oh, somebody else should have over-monitored them. It was Eric Bischoff's job to balance the budget. The people in that position before him, like Bill Watts, were brought in specifically to get the company in the black. So to say that it's not Bischoff's role is completely ridiculous. It's absolutely his job to keep his eye on how much money the company is or isn't making. I think that from the collective things that took place from Hogan, Nash, lack of forward vision, lack of anything other than living in the now is completely negligent. It's complete malpractice. WCW is dead. It's never coming back. And Eric Bischoff, I feel, is the main reason why.
Thank you very much. To the prosecution, we now move to the defence for their closing arguments.
Thank you, Your Honour. There was a lot of a passion and vigour. Vitriol, in fact, in that closing statement. And I think that's important. I think the tone of that closing statement is important, because as my Right Honourable colleague Kieran O'Rourke has mentioned, I believe that there is an element of persecution involved here, a witch hunt. The prosecution is clearly hurt and clearly mourning over the loss of a company, and it's not for me to necessarily say how one should grieve. But in this instance, I feel that to be so adamant in the guilt of one man is misguided. This is a situation where the defence have acknowledged there was a parent company involved, and they have mentioned that Eric Bischoff should have been keeping his eye on expenses. Now, I'm not going to say that Eric Bischoff isn't culpable to some extent. I wouldn't wish to mislead anyone and be disingenuous in that regard. But there was a parent company. There were other people charged with overseeing the spending, who, as we have stressed time and time again and will continue to do so, had the ability to rein said spending in. True, someone such as Bill Watts was brought in to reduce the overheads. But Eric Bischoff wasn't given that remit. Eric Bischoff was given the remit of compete with the World Wrestling Federation. And the tools that he was given at his disposal, he was given free rein to a large extent. But is that Eric Bischoff's fault? No. I would argue that is the fault of the parent company. They are the ones ultimately in charge and the ones who should be ultimately responsible. This is a company which, let's not forget, had hemorrhaged money prior to Eric Bischoff and had lost money before Ted Turner's buyout. We would argue in the prosecution that without the success that Eric Bischoff brought the company, that it may well have died years before it did. They have reeled off several names, all of which can be attributed a portion of blame. Yes, Hulk Hogan was given creative control, but Hulk Hogan himself was selfish in his actions. Kevin Nash was allowed to be booker, but Kevin Nash was selfish and short-sighted in the burying of Bill Goldberg. I believe that we have heard the phrase murder on one occasion from the prosecution. Well, to use the murder analogy, when it comes to trying someone for murder, you don't try the person that supplied the bullets and the gun. They are merely an accomplice. They are the lesser individual. It is the person that pulled the trigger who is most culpable. Now, the parent company and Ted Turner had to oversee this. They are the ones that ultimately allowed for all of this to be green-lighted. I am of the opinion, and I believe that my colleague, Mr. O'Rourke, will agree with me here, that this is far too complex, far too multi-layered a situation to pin solely on one person. And with that in mind, we would urge the judge to, in this instance, throw out the case. The defence rests.
Well, having listened to the arguments both for and against, it's now time for me to wrap up, give my final thoughts and reflect on what we've heard so far. I think that there's been some fantastic opinions presented both from the prosecution and the defence, as well as the feedback that we've had. I think the feedback has been a fantastic standard this particular time around. And I do feel that really you can put a razor down the middle of this one. You know, I think that it's a really close decision. I think that we've heard a lot of other people's names be brought into the argument. I think what that is almost a testament to is the fact that ultimately maybe Bischoff is definitely guilty of not being strong enough, isn't in a position of leadership and management. There were some great points that were made in the feedback that centered around this idea that once Hogan had set the bar with creative control, everyone else just kind of got given it whether they had it or not, and especially if you could shout loud enough or get paid enough money. So I think that a big point of my verdict on this settles on what your opinion is on the management responsibility and culpability that Bischoff had. Was he the highest point on the totem pole as far as the guilt around the death of WCW needs to go? Or actually, do we look to the people who were above him and what, you know, should they have kept tabs, checks and balances, you know, tighter control on Bischoff? ultimately, I think that where that is regarded, Bischoff's early successes gave him that freedom. You know, he did have a proven track record of making success in those couple of early years he took over. It then became that, you know, as time drew on, probably eyes weren't on him close enough. I think that there's been, you know, some really interesting arguments from the prosecution. And gentlemen, you have to remember that the burden of proof sits on you. So when I make my decision, you have to prove to me without reasonable doubt that Eric Bischoff was the person most responsible for the death of WCW. With that in mind, if we had a drum roll, I don't think the budget stretches that far. If we had a drum roll, we'd roll it now. And I would,
we might
like
be able to insert the prices.
I would like to note that I find Eric Bischoff on the charge of being the person most responsible for the death of WCW not guilty.
Yes! Oh,
fuck!
I think that there are a number of people that contributed to the death of this company. My job here today, and the job certainly of the defence also, wasn't to find someone else who was more guilty. But what I don't feel was proven today was that ultimately a big enough margin of guilt sat on Bischoff's shoulders to be the person most responsible. I think there are a number of factors, almost a comedy of errors, if you will, that led to the demise of this company. But in fairness, this company that we're talking about being dead still sells a shit ton of DVDs. It fills a number of hours on this network that we all wish we had here in the UK, but don't quite get talk point at the moment. Put that on trial next time, folks. But I think that what I definitely feel today is, you know, as much as I would love to give the nod to the prosecution, but I would like to say you guys did a great job, I don't feel that there is enough evidence here to put Eric Bischoff down for this one, Governor. Gentlemen of the defence as well, thank you very much for your time.
Just to wrap up a little kind of verdict talk here.
the aftermath.
A bit of a post-show.
Okay.
Because this is something that that Halty said off-air in terms of like what we really feel. Because I went into this wanting to be the prosecution, thinking that it would be a challenge, but don't personally believe Bischoff is guilty. Chase is on the other hand, but he was a little bit 50-50, right?
Yeah, I was actually 50-50 because I actually quite liked Bischoff. And so I was... whilst I think obviously he at the time I believed he was responsible for certain things, I just thought he was also responsible for a lot of great things, and that the blame lied with other people. But that actually changed once I actually started researching it, and I actually do genuinely now believe that he is actually responsible for it. I mean, yes, other people, Vince Russo, did do their part as well, but I think Eric Bischoff, his name just comes up way too often.
Yeah, Carl and Kieran, I want to know what your actual true feelings on this are. Now that we've got all the boom and bluster and all the stuff out of the way, the bravado, a great effort, and congratulations on victory. I'll give you the nod. What are your true thoughts on this?
I said quite a few times in that trial about how Bischoff gave it a stay of execution. If I'm honest, I always think it was Ted Turner that gave it the stay of execution, because before the Time Warner thing, he didn't really care if it made money or not, as I think some people mentioned. Bischoff, to my mind, he did a lot of damage towards the end, and I'll never excuse him of that, but I've always felt that the company was still salvageable in September. You know, the losses, I'm not saying they would have turned the company around and made it profitable, the losses could have been mitigated. Kieran made an excellent point off air about the fact that Russo's stuff was just in, you know, bad booking is one thing. I'm sorry, cause I'm stealing your thunder here completely. bad booking is one thing, but the Russo stuff was just insulting and drove the audience away in droves. So I think even in September of 99, with the right person in charge and the right oversight, they could have mitigated the losses to the point where another TV company may have looked into it and may have been interested.
It's a tough one. I think the consensus opinion on most people is it was a cumulative effect why WCW went down. Perfect storm, really.
Of shit.
Perfect storm, yes,
perfect
shit storm.
Very much a shit at the fan.
Yeah. Individual blame. Bischoff was massively influential. Any way you slice it, he did take it to heights they had never got to, but I genuinely believe some of the underlying factors were led to the long-term decline. But he didn't kill the company for me. I truly believe that. It just seems to continually got worse. So from Bischoff down to Russo, down to the invasion, which we talked about previously. It was a continual downward spiral, but all brought about really by the instigation of the war in the first place. I think when once you put both companies under such a spotlight, there was always a comparison, but a head-to-head direct conflict in comparison, it puts a spotlight and an emphasis on results which wouldn't be there previously. I mean, the results which caused Bischoff to get fired, he probably would have got fired back in 92. Maybe he would have, who knows. But the spotlight, if he'd got those results in 94, the perception of him is completely different from coming into a wrestling war. And it's the ego thing as well. When they lose, you know, after kicking WWF's ass for so long, when the tables are finally turned, there's a certain hyperbolic reaction to that, which might be out of proportion given the fact that where the company had actually come from and what the logistics of it still were, and what they'd actually achieved over that period. So yeah, he fucked up massively on loads of occasions. I think what Halty said, actually the key thing about the lack of leadership, I think that's the biggest thing you could throw at him, was the lack of leadership. And it puts it back to what he's actually, who Eric Bischoff is. And yeah, he's a car salesman at the end of the day, so.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why Kieran O'Rourke was the team captain.
You said that twice, while I've been calculating. You've spoken approximately 65% of the defence time.
Yeah, but that was thanks to your excellent leadership, which allowed me the platform to do so.
Oh, listen to this, tying it all in together in a beautiful segue.
Well, we did win.
We did.
It definitely almost begs the question, in Kieran's thoughts there, of is this sort of perfect beast of a runner of a wrestling company? You could argue it ends up being Vince McMahon, but is it a combination of Bischoff and Heyman for Bischoff's lack of leadership skills and ability to control his talent? He definitely probably had more business savvy, but Heyman comes in with the lack of business but this ability to rally the troops around him to give more than they really should do, whereas with the opposite with WCW, it just seems like so many people are on the take.
Yeah. On the take.
Jack Tunney wasn't even there.
The only thing I'll say on that is they might be great, but I wouldn't want either of them doing my taxes if they were the judging by what we've heard today. And so, as it turns out, the only person that was actually full of shit this entire debate was me, which backfired on me massively, because that's not what I was expecting you to say. So,
and on that point, I will say, sustained.
I want to thank everybody for all the feedback. I want to thank everybody for listening this far. For G. John Chase,
a guilty man walked free today.
For Matt Holt, the Honourable, and a fantastic job.
Order! Possibly next time, gents, as I've learned today, throwing coffee at Eddie Guerrero might have been a better part, because that one was new to me.
For Carl Jones,
I'm off to the Gold Club to celebrate.
And for Kieran O'Rourke,
if you're in trouble and you don't know who's called, call me and Carl.
Thanks.
Just think, you didn't do it.
I'm Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.